Welcome to the Theology Mill, brought to you by Wittfenstock Publishers. I'm your host, Zach Mickle. In this podcast, we interview some of the leading authors in theology, biblical studies, philosophy, and more. Many of the folks we talk with on the show are also authors with us at Wittfenstock, where we have the honor of putting into print a broad swath of work that we hope nourishes both the academy and the church. On this episode, I got to interview Connor Sweeney. So Dr. Sweeney is a professor of theology at Christendom College, and he's also the author of a handful of books with us at Cascade, including, most pertinent to this interview, his book Sacramental Presence After Heidegger, Ontotheology, Sacraments, and the Mother's Smile. So in the interview, Professor Sweeney and I have a conversation about Heidegger, sacramental theology, John Paul II, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, and a whole lot more. So with that, friends, let's jump over to the interview. Let's get started by talking about phenomenology sort of broadly. How would you define it or describe it? I think it's a bit elusive to people who aren't familiar. So how would you describe it or define it to someone who doesn't know anything about it?
Yeah, and I'll begin by thanking you for asking me for a very basic understanding of phenomenology. I mean, I'm sure hearing that you're going to interview Immanuel Falk, I mean, he's going to be able to give you the really heavy duty stuff. So I'm quite happy to, you know, skirt around the edges. But obviously you take the word phenomenology and you can just look at the word to start, and obviously you break it down and you've got the word phenomenon in there. And very basically, phenomenology is interested above all in the phenomenon, the given reality. So givenness, that which gives itself to be known by the human mind, not necessarily as an abstract thing, but as a living reality. This is sort of the object that phenomenologists are interested in. So along with the phenomenon, therefore, we talk about the category of experience. And often that's specified with the term or the word lived. So we're interested in lived experience, as opposed to the symbols or the representations by which we might describe that experience. So the phenomenologist wants to go to the living reality, the whole, the relations, the phenomenon itself of givenness, and try to conceive of that anew, afresh, and hopefully then to gain more insight into the fullness of reality. So Edmund Husserl, sort of the founding father of phenomenology, he had this very wonderful, evocative, rallying cry, if you will. And it's kind of a cry that takes place against the background of Kantian philosophy. Anyway, he spoke of this imperative to go back to the things in themselves. So, you know, we have all these representations, we have this whole history of interpretation, this metaphysical heritage, whether you want to talk about the scholastic approach, whether you want to talk about the idealist approach. And Husserl was sort of the mind, well, in some sense, we've lost contact with the real, with the stuff of reality itself. And maybe, therefore, we should bracket all of these representations. Bracketing, that's another technical word. Maybe we should suspend all of our interpretations and try to return back to the reality itself. And then hopefully within that new attentiveness to experience, to the phenomenon, we can once again start to enter into a more living, dynamic relationship with reality. So I guess that would be my nutshell introduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great nutshell. What would you say are maybe two or three books that are kind of a good starting point for people who want to start learning phenomenology?
Yeah, if you're interested in phenomenology as a technical discipline, as a methodology, according to some of its major proponents, I would recommend starting with a book by Robert Sokolowski, simply called Introduction to Phenomenology. It's not necessarily an easy text, and so there is a specific terminology that is involved here in regards to the phenomenological discipline. But Sokolovsky will really walk you through some of those technical terms and phrases. And so he sort of gives an account of how these phrases and understandings come from, say, Husserlian philosophy. I wouldn't recommend beginning your phenomenological journey by reading Edmund Husserl. I remember I tried to read him as an undergrad. He's got this two-volume work called, Logical Investigations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would think the man who cried, you know, back to the things themselves, you'd think this would read like a breath of fresh air. actually, it doesn't. It's very technical. And he's after very much a kind of scientific understanding of reality, still in a kind of recognizable Cartesian Enlightenment way, you might say. And there's a whole technical jargon associated with that. That was one of Heidegger's complaints with Husserl, was that he still remained too within the Enlightenment spirit. But anyway, if you're wanting to wade through some of that important history of phenomenology and the kinds of concepts and terms that you get from it, Sokolovsky is certainly helpful in that regard. Beyond that, from my point of view, and I often come at phenomenology from a kind of theological perspective, or rather I come at it with theological aims in mind. So I use phenomenology more as a kind of mode, as opposed to a technique or a methodology, a kind of posture in relation to theological things. And my first experience with phenomenology actually came through John Paul II. Back before he became Pope, he was Karol Wojtyła, and he did a lot of phenomenological work. He was associated with the so-called Lublin School in Poland, which tried to bring together Thomism and contemporary philosophy, phenomenology in a specific way. So I sort of cut my teeth on Wojtyła's take, and there's a few texts you could jump into. It's maybe perhaps not the best introductory text. I've actually got one here. It's his Person and Community, an essay. You'll see a lot of discussion of things like lived experience and subjectivity. He's interested in the interior dimension of the person and how that dimension interfaces with the external world, trying to connect those two worlds together. Another one here, Love and Responsibility. This is his work on sexual ethics from a kind of phenomenological perspective. In some sense, he's trying to bring phenomenology, bring it together with Thomism in a certain way. That's helpful as well. And finally, this one here, this behemoth of a text, The Theology of the Body, that's been formative of me as well. Mm-hmm. And you can see his phenomenological consciousness, his way of thinking, really come through, for example, when he's talking about the creation accounts. He's trying to grapple with the meaning of man, created as man and woman in the image and likeness of God. And you see him employ certain phenomenological techniques in that regard. So that's a good example, I guess, Wojtyła, JP2, of how phenomenology doesn't necessarily have to remain sort of as a separated discipline, a specific methodology, but it can, in fact, fruitfully interface with other disciplines as well.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's nice that his work, I mean, it's not light reading, it's not easy reading, but it's certainly not like reading Levinas or Husserl, which is refreshing.
It's like every couple of paragraphs, it gives you something. Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yes. I can hold on to this.
Yes, absolutely. It's not like one nugget per two pages or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, you may have already kind of answered this, because I know you brought out your John Paul II books, but who is your favorite phenomenologist to read? And then the second question is, what is maybe your most treasured volume of phenomenology?
I mean, I think probably JP2, Wojtyła, because in some sense he was my way into phenomenology. That remains a point of reference. And I like the way he's integrating phenomenology with theology. So he's been formative in that regard. And those are texts that I often return to. As much as Heidegger was painful, Heidegger obviously is a kind of seminal figure. And I don't think you can really understand contemporary phenomenology as a discipline apart from Heidegger. And so I do find myself going back to Heidegger as well. I actually taught him in class this past week, which doesn't happen very often. So it's always enjoyable to dip back into Heidegger. And there are very, very interesting things in Heidegger, obviously, that are very important.
I am interested as well in the so-called theological turn in phenomenology there, where phenomenology kind of goes, in these thinkers, goes beyond Husserl, who kind of wanted to exclude questions of the invisible realm, the religious realm, properly speaking. So there's a whole cohort of primarily French phenomenologists, of which Immanuel Falk is belongs to in some sense, who sort of took up this notion that phenomenology concerns not just the visible, but also the invisible. So religious phenomenon, those are genuine phenomena as well. And the phenomenologist should take into account the whole range of human experience. So when you consider human civilization, human history, I mean, clearly religion one way or another has figured in it. And so I think it does make sense for the phenomenologist to not sort of a priori think of that as sophistry and illusion, as Hume might have put it, but as a genuine phenomenon in its own right. We might bracket, you know, belief in said theological claims, but I think it's true to say that the phenomenologist needs to take that into account. An example of that would be Jean-Luc Marion, and he's another one that I return to often. He certainly pops up in my sacramental presence book. Some very, very interesting things in Marion, notions like he talks about excess. There always being an excess, more to be found in any experience of givenness. And so the phenomenologist should never sort of close things off and say, well, this account exhausts this phenomenon. No, says Marion, there's always something more. You can always come at something from another angle. And so I think there's insight there. He also talks about the saturated phenomenon. Some phenomena are like saturated to excess. And the example that he gives here are religious phenomena like the Eucharist, for example. So Marion has a very strong theological sensibility and is a good representation of how phenomenology and theology come together in a particular way.
Sure.
So he's certainly been important as well.
Sure. Yeah. You're kind of wading into the territory of the jargon with some of Marion's terms. One of the questions we've asked you and also the other two folks we're interviewing is about this jargon and what are kind of the key terms people should know the most or that are the most important. So what would you say are maybe a few of those, and then how would you define them?
Mm. Well, I've mentioned lived experience and the notion of experience, the category of experience, and this is sort of the field within which the real is appropriated. So the phenomenologist has to be attentive to experience. You can't solve or answer life's problems with just theory, you might say. And the analogy I would use here is that you're never going to be a good golfer unless you're also a good phenomenologist. So you might hit the course with all the best theory and even the best technique theoretically in the world, but when you step up to the tee, you've got to actually bring it all together in the moment, and you've got to be aware of your surroundings. You've got to be aware of the condition of your body. I mean, if you've worked out the day before, probably you're going to be stiff, and I speak from experience. I took up golf over the summer in a serious way. I've got some serious goals there.
Okay.
But in order to golf well, you've got to take into account your surroundings. So what's the wind doing? What's the yardage? All of these things. Going into that simply with theoretical knowledge is not going to be enough. And in some sense, you're going to limit yourself. You're going to hobble yourself if you're not actually aware of your surroundings and taking it all in and not simply judging it according to preconceived conditions. So being aware of experience, being aware of what gives, givenness, this is another important notion. Along with this is the notion of subjectivity, personal subjectivity. So this recognition that there are these interior depths to the person. There's a subjectivity in the person such that I'm not just reducible down to things, down to the external world. Voiti was very interested in that dimension. Another one would be intentionality. And this has to do with the conscious relationship we have to an object. And for the phenomenologist, it's always intentionality for or to something. It's never intentionality, consciousness that is sort of locked in itself. And so you could sort of say this is almost a response to Descartes in the sense that, well, real knowledge is not generated by closing yourself in a dark room, shutting everything out. Rather, real knowledge is always your consciousness taking an object, your intentionality engaging the world. And that interface becomes the foundation, the basis of reality. So aspects of phenomenology seek to sort of roll back that subject-object dichotomy, which is sort of solidified after after Descartes. A little more technically, phenomenologists distinguish between the natural attitude versus the phenomenological attitude. So the natural attitude is sort of like your natural unreflective mode of being in the world. The phenomenological attitude tries to, you know, sort of look at things in a new way to sort of suspend or bracket. There's another one. Suspend or bracket, you know, the interpretive lens by which you have seen these things or by which you naturally see these things, the things you've inherited from your family, from your nation, from your religion, perhaps. In some sense, you need to bracket that in order to attend to reality in a more immediate way. And so that distinction between natural attitude, phenomenological attitude is important. And I think for Marion, he would sort of equate the natural attitude with a particular, in the West at least, with a particular metaphysical way of seeing the world that in some sense is embedded in our culture and our social activity. And so part of being a phenomenologist then would be to suspend that, to try and look at reality itself as it gives itself, to see if that metaphysical representation actually is legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are the first that sort of come to mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I like the analogy of golf. And so I actually like golf. I'm not a golfer. I actually tried to pick it up one time.
Oh, yeah.
Because my father-in-law is really into golf. I bought this series of lessons to learn at the like country club in my hometown. So I was studying it a ton. And on my second lesson, you know, I kept gripping it too tight. I'm sure you're very familiar with this now.
Yeah.
And really trying to like hammer the ball. And my tutor kept telling me, you know, you got to loosen your grip. You got to loosen your grip. And we're on the driving range. And I listened to her, but too much, I guess. And so I swung it and my club went about 40 yards out into the driving range.
Oh, yeah. There's like a whole genre of YouTube videos with people losing their club like that.
Yeah. So I gave up.
No, it's got to be the most frustrating sport ever.
Yeah. I gave up though. I didn't finish the rest of my lessons. But so I do like that analogy of like, I mean, I'm more of a basketball player, but there are plenty of people who watch basketball and know it really, really well. And then you go out on a court with them and they have no idea how to play. So I think that's a
theory can only get you so far.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Let's move to some of your own work. So your book, Sacramental Presence After Heidegger, it's sort of tracing some of the discussions around sacramentality and divine presence in the wake of Heidegger. So you're dealing especially with Chauvet and Bova. I'm not actually sure how to pronounce the latter.
Yeah, it's pretty close. I think it's like Bova.
Bova.
I just say Bove.
Okay. Was he French as well?
I think he's Belgian.
Belgian. Okay. But anyway, so you're tracing some of those discussions after Heidegger, who, you know, Heidegger, of course, kind of claims that Western metaphysics and its ontotheology had kind of in their development actually forgotten being itself as something that's actually historical and temporal and phenomenological and things like this. So I guess my question is, what does Heidegger really mean by this term ontotheology? And then what does he propose as sort of his own ontological alternative?
Yeah, that's one of the
most important questions you could probably ask about Heidegger. And I remember starting my doctorate and I kept coming across this term, ontotheology. And it seemed like every author that I read had a slightly different interpretation of it. And seriously, it took me like a year and a half doctoral research to finally reach the point where I think I kind of understand what Heidegger was on about. So we'll see if I can represent that today. I actually had a student ask me yesterday in class if I could give a definition of ontotheology. Mm. So we'll see if I can do it again. Mm. But you're right. Basically, it has to do with his particular interpretation of Western metaphysics. And he goes back as far as Plato and says there is this ontotheological tendency that begins here in the kind of rationalizing tendency of Greek philosophy that is then consummated by Christian approach to things. And finally, he thinks it reaches its terminus in our modern age of technology. So he thinks you can draw a straight line between that kind of metaphysics, the kind of metaphysics that thinks it can penetrate into the being of something and pin down its meaning and give this conceptual representational definition of the real there. He thinks the pretension to do that by way of metaphysical concepts is then carried over in this absolute drive to know, and then to control reality, manipulate reality. And so we end up with the age of technology. And in some sense, he's quite deterministic in terms of our capacity to come into a more primordial contact with being within this technological world that we've created. So he begins Being in Time with what became this famous statement. He said, today, being has been forgotten. So he thinks the approach to being typical of metaphysics, this drive to know, this drive to define and represent, he thinks has ultimately stunted being in its essential reality as mystery. And so for him, we need to destruction is the German word he uses, conveniently very like the English word. That's the word he uses in relation to our need to go beyond this Western tradition of metaphysics. Now, I've been presuming the word ontotheology here, and it's probably helpful if I were to just break down this word to sort of see exactly what it means. So we can break it up, obviously, into two bits, the onto and the theological. And the onto simply refers to this ontological tendency, this tendency to think you can actually define the essence of thing in a kind of abstract, ahistorical way, so I can pin down the real with this representation. And Heidegger ultimately says, well, no, that's not true, because he says meaning always takes place in history according to temporality, time, context, history, change. He thinks this means that you can never arrive at an absolute definition of anything. And this ought to therefore humble us in regards to this drive to know, this drive to define. Now, somewhere along the way, he thinks this onto becomes hooked up to the theo, the God, theology, as the ultimate sort of legitimating principle. And so sort of in a cosmological approach, well, Thomas would say we can argue from created effect back up to eternal and infinite causes, and therefore we can posit God as like the ultimate reality behind it all. And somehow this God is also creator. Everything is an image of God. Everything comes from God. And so God therefore becomes this kind of absolute principle that guarantors or backs up your ontological claims. So when you put it together, it becomes this ontotheology that Heidegger thinks ultimately has trampled over the genuine historicity and temporality of being. And so his approach, I like to tell students, is kind of like, well, what do we do in the face of this? What do we do in the face of this as it's played out in the domain of technology? Well, basically, he says the best we can do is sort of humble ourselves before reality, take up a kind of fundamentally contemplative savoring of being, a contemplative posture in relation to being. Let being give itself, receive being, let being speak. And in some sense, you could say just to shut up and let being reveal itself to you. And so this whole notion of not speaking becomes sort of what you start to see in people like Derrida or who's that other guy I'm thinking of? Weak theology, Giano Vattima, for example. Basically, our ability to express the real is sort of over, they would say, and therefore all we can basically do is sort of contemplate, wait, and refuse to sort of foreclose the event of being's revelation, something like that.
Yeah, that's a really nice, like, textured picture of what Heidegger's up to. I know when I first tried to read Being and Time, well, first of all, it's quite long. I got about 60 or 70 pages in. And I think for me, I was reading the John Macquarie and Robinson translation. I don't know what the other one reads like, but there's several German words they don't translate, the foremost being the sign. And I got so frustrated because I didn't have a sense of what the sign was. So I felt like I was tracking with some things, but the core thrust of the book is this idea of the sign. I couldn't quite grasp it. And then so I had to kind of go back and read some intro to Heidegger sort of work. And then I was like, okay, now I feel like I have somewhat of a grasp of it. But what would you, or I guess, how would you describe Heidegger's idea of the sign? And especially in kind of its relationship towards being towards death, as he calls it.
Yeah, that's another critical Heideggerian notion, of course, Dasein. Well, you can probably start by looking at it literally, and you can just break up the word. That doesn't necessarily take us the whole way, and in some sense it creates a kind of misconception. But obviously, Dasein, it's a compound word, da and sein, sein meaning to be, da as means there, so literally to be there or being there, which doesn't really help much in and of itself. And so you have to understand how that context, how that works within the context of Heidegger's overall thinking, particularly his critique of ontotheology. So what it basically refers to is being, or the posture of being, in some sense, outside of metaphysics. It's a mode of being in the world, and there's another important notion, in der Welt sein, being in the world via this kind of contemplative posture. So because we're part of history, because my being is located in time, temporally, a particular time and space, a particular culture, it's always going to be limited. And what I can say, what I can think, thinks Heidegger, is always limited by that horizon of time. So Dasein, in a sense, is being limited by time. And the proper posture of the person within this situation is always to be open to being as it gives itself anew in each moment. So there's a very temporal dimension here in regards to Dasein. And as part of this, this notion of being towards death. So Heidegger, of course, is not Christian in any recognizable way. And so for him, the event of Christ, for example, the message of salvation, redemption, he doesn't necessarily buy that. And so for him, part of Dasein's temporality is this inevitability of death. And in some sense, all thought always takes place within finitude, within our being towards death as its fundamental condition. This should cause you to chasten your ambitions, as it were, to define the real in any radical ultimate sense, because you are simply being towards death, a finite, temporal, limited, contextual creature. So I think that's kind of how that figures into his overall ontology here.
Got it. Yeah, that's super helpful. We had started to dig into a little bit of kind of what you're up to in your book, Sacramental Presence After Heidegger, where you're covering a number of thinkers, but particularly you're dealing with two sacramental theologians who follow in the wake of Heidegger's call for like an overcoming or a destruction of metaphysics, right? We've talked about it a little bit already, Louis-Marie Chauvet, and then I'm going to butcher his first name, Levin Buva. At least I know how to pronounce his last name now.
That's good.
And then, so in the end, though, you sort of propose Hanserz von Balthasar's kind of rehabilitated metaphysics as a corrective, maybe, for some of the excesses of Chauvet and Buva's postmodernism. So what do you feel von Balthasar's metaphysics has to offer such postmodern narratives around, especially as they pertain to being? And then kind of more generally, why should philosophers and theologians after Heidegger still care at all about metaphysics?
Yeah, and that's really the crutch of the issue here. And certainly if you read Sacramental Presence after Heidegger, it is taking into account Heidegger. It's taking into account how Heidegger has shaped a particular generation of theologians. But in the end, I sort of pin my flag to the mast of Balthasar, and like you say, his kind of rehabilitated metaphysics vis-a-vis thinkers like Chauvet and Bouve. So in some sense, at this point, I'm not necessarily doing that on the basis of a strictly metaphysical, or rather a strictly philosophical approach. So I would define myself first and foremost as a theologian, and as a theologian, as a believer, I would take the incarnation as like the supreme event par excellence in human history. And you could say the incarnation as an objective historical fact, and certainly from the point of view of faith, as the fact of God made man in Jesus Christ, is an event of ontological density, you could say. A historical event that, in some sense, the believer takes as supreme and paramount. And if that event is true in that way, then we would say, look, there is such a thing as an ultimate truth and meaning to experience. There's a possibility here, an infinite possibility that is given if, in fact, God speaks to man as he does in Christ. Now, Heidegger, near the end of his life, once said in an interview with the German magazine Der Spiegel, he said, only a God can save us. And perhaps where I diverge from Heidegger is that I believe, well, yes, only a God can save us, and that God has addressed himself to us in Jesus Christ, and this has become the supreme event par excellence that now enters into our description of things. So to a certain extent, Balthasar clings to the mystery of the incarnation, clings to the history of faith in a way, obviously, that Heidegger doesn't. There is a reality, there is a truth there that is beyond simple history, beyond the flux of time, beyond the limitations of the creature, in some sense, mired in temporality and time, as Heidegger would say. And so this becomes the basis then for Balthasar's rehabilitated metaphysics, in which he does take into account the achievements, for example, of St. Thomas Aquinas. He doesn't necessarily follow the methodology of Thomas, but certainly Thomas's basic metaphysical insights here are fundamentally crucial for Balthasar. And ultimately that sort of brought into contact with the perspective of faith as well. And so I think Balthasar thus does much better justice to the depth of truth that I still think remains possible for the believer. So ultimately, we're not just mired in experience qua experience, just the fact of experience. There is still a normative truth. There's a voice of being that speaks to man in something more than simply the present moment. We can talk about like the voice of conscience, for example, the fact that my being resonates with some things and clashes with other, this sort of anamnesis memory within the human experience. And so there's a depth to experience, there's a potential for experience here that I think Christian faith best brings out in the sense of fulfilling the possibility, the aspiration, the desires of the creature. And so ultimately then I think that Balthasar is a better phenomenologist, you could say, than Heidegger, than Chauvet, than Bouve. And ultimately I think there is more there in terms of moving the human person towards a genuine fullness of experience, if you will.
Yeah, Yeah, there's sort of more of a dynamism, I think you're right. Yeah, I can definitely hear the influence of the Communio guys on you when you're talking. Like,
that's the other big plank in my formation. Yeah. So, you know, JP2, Ratzinger, yeah. Balthazar, the Lubach, sure. The whole Resource Mont movement, which, you know, it's very phenomenological. It's this going back to the source, mm-hmm. and back to the reality itself. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you know, I certainly see their ability to go back into the bone marrow of faith, the living reality of faith, the baptismal reality of faith. I mean, phenomenology, a phenomenological sort of approach, has the power to open those experiences up in a new way. And so certainly that's kind of the way I think, mm-hmm. Theologically.
Sure, sure, sure. So let's keep talking about von Balthasar since we're on the topic. So in your book, you talk about how within design, as you know, Heidegger's term, you incorporate also the mother's smile, which is a term you're borrowing from Balthasar. So in your book, you're touching on both kind of the negative and the positive features of this mother's smile, right? So it's nature as sort of an ontological gift, but also its relationship to finitude. So what is this mother's smile, for those who aren't familiar, and how does it fit, so to speak, within Heidegger's sense of design?
Yeah, the mother's smile. I mean, I love the mother's smile because, in a sense, it speaks both to the phenomenologist and to the metaphysician. It's like it tells the phenomenologist that there's always more to experience. There's a greater truth. And in some sense, you can't limit and foreclose that truth when it gives itself. And to the metaphysician, it says, look, at the end of the day, your representations are not reality itself. You have to immerse yourself in reality and experience if you're actually going to encounter the real. And simply the fact here that the incarnation is a historical event. And that's kind of the ground of Christian faith. I came prepared, and I'll actually just read a selection from Balthasar, if you don't mind,
go for it.
And then sort of offer some commentary on it. So this is what Balthasar says here in regards to the mother's smile. It's one instance of about half a dozen where this does feature in his thinking. So he says, after mother has smiled at her child for many days and weeks, she finally receives her child's smile in response. She has awakened love in the heart of her child. And as a child awakens to love, it also awakens to knowledge. The initially empty sense impressions gather meaningfully around the core of the thou. So you could say, first, we've got this notion of relationality. You don't come to being, you don't come to consciousness except in and through the others. And I like to tell my students these stories of children who are sometimes raised by dogs with no, there are these stories of, with no human contact. Mm-hmm. And they don't grow up in any recognizably human mm-hmm. way. Without that human contact, human interaction, their human potential is not actually mm-hmm. realized. So this I-thou relational dynamic here is fundamental. And that's kind of what's going on here in this paradigm of the mother and the child. So what happens, of course, is when you're child is born, you know, they can't take it all in. Everything is these empty sense impressions. They can't organize it. But for Balthasar, somehow the mother's smile is allowing the child to focus. The child focuses on the mother's smile and finally is able to respond to it. And so it's love, ultimately, a relation, which brings this child to knowledge, brings this child to consciousness. And Balthasar would say that's real consciousness. That's real knowledge within this experience of being loved. So he says knowledge with its whole complex of intuition and concept comes into play because the play of love has already begun beforehand, initiated by the mother, who represents here the transcendent. Now, more theologically, I think there's a metaphysics buried in this insight. True knowledge, knowledge of reality, comes into being by experience. So in that sense, at some point, phenomenology has to strike out into the realm of metaphysics. It can never do so on the basis of forgetting that it's love that is actually the context. Love, relationality,
as the ground level without which we can have representation. So metaphysics goes wrong when it brackets that insight and turns our attention solely to concepts and representations. Anyway, the next part of this passage is more theological. So he's saying there's an analogy here between the mother and the child and the way that God relates to the creature. So he says, God interprets himself to man as love in the same way. He radiates love, which kindles the light of man, love in the heart of man. And it is precisely this light that allows man to perceive this, the ultimate, absolute love. And quoting 2 Corinthians 4:6, he says, "For it is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." In this face, the face of Christ, the beginning of true knowledge, the primal foundation of being, smiles at us as a mother and as a father. Insofar as we are his creatures, the seed of love lies dormant within us as the image of God. We bear the image, the divine spark. We participate in the logos in our creation. We have this capacity. But just as no child can be awakened to love without being loved, so too no human heart can come to an understanding of God without the free gift of his grace in the image of his Son. But when this happens, when this divine mystery breaks into what is symbolized here in the image of the mother smile, true knowledge can begin, a true encounter with reality can begin. And I think the word metaphysics can legitimately be used in this sense at this point.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's just such a more like satisfactory response to Heidegger. I think it's richer, and I think the like sheer genius and like just breadth of Balthasar really comes through there. But also it's more hopeful.
Yeah, and I think it's more phenomenologically rigorous in the sense that, you know, philosophers, you know, forgive me, philosophers, but you guys aren't very good at love. I mean, Arion is an exception. I mean, he takes love into account seriously, and he's shaped by Balthasar, right, you could say. But philosophers traditionally aren't that good at love. And I think without love, you really miss out on the central mystery of human existence.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate, too, the placement of Balthasar as a corrective, because I think in some ways, like he's not camped very often. I've never heard him camped as a phenomenologist or in the world of phenomenology. Whereas like JP2 and Edith Stein are a couple Catholic thinkers who still have a relationship with metaphysics that's positive in some respects. But because both of them were actually formally trained in phenomenology. But I think von Balthasar, the way he undertakes the theological task is actually really phenomenological, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different. It's very eccentric. I mean, his own formation is quite unique, and his mode of doing theology is very unique. And, you know, the more I read Balthasar, the more I sort of attune myself to that way of thinking myself. So it's definitely been life-giving for me.
Yeah, I think that's a great place for us to finish up. I just want to say thank you again for taking the time. This was a really, really rich conversation. Thanks for listening to the Theology Mill, brought to you by Wittfenstock Publishers. If you liked what you heard and would like to hear more, you can subscribe to our show, where we have a lot more content coming your way. I'm your host, Zach Mickle, signing off on this episode of the Theology Mill. We hope to see you again to share a drink and talk all things theology. But until then, God bless, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.